طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح. طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice, that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham, and we continue it in his memory. This is John Roberts. We begin this morning with a very critical analysis of the dearth of political leadership within Palestine today. A critique written by Rami Khoury, who is professor of journalism at the American University in Beirut and a senior fellow at the Kennedy School of Government. It is both an analysis and a plea for change of the Palestinian leadership. Rami Khoury writes, "The crushing irony for Palestinians today is their cause remains widely supported by over 120 governments and billions of ordinary men and women around the world, yet the Palestinian leadership is a case study in hapless incompetence that verges on national shame. This was confirmed again as the Central Council of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the PLO, issued a policy statement after days of deliberations that is a sad example of meaningless clichés uttered by aging men whose track record of political achievement is empty, and astoundingly so, in view of the massive and sustained support around the world for Palestinian national rights. The Central Council is supposed to fill the gap between the National Council, the parliament in exile, that represents all Palestinians around the world, and the executive committee that represents the major Palestinian political factions and functions like a government cabinet, headed by the president. In fact, these three organs of government and the presidency are all moribund institutions that have neither impact nor legitimacy, for the leadership has lost touch with the ordinary Palestinians whom it is supposed to represent and serve." So it is no surprise that after a fiery but hollow speech by President Mahmoud Abbas, the Central Council has decided to suspend its recognition of Israel, end security cooperation with Israel, effectively nullify the 2003 Oslo Accords, and call on the world for the creation of a Palestinian state and end Israel's colonization policies. These meaningless words by a powerless leadership will have no impact on anything. It is hard to know what else to say or do in the face of such a failed leadership of a noble Palestinian people that continues to struggle, mostly nonviolently, for their peaceful statehood and end to refugeehood and exile, alongside an Israeli state that would acknowledge these rights for Palestine. But we must do something, because simply continuing with the same inept leadership that has excluded the vast majority of Palestinians from participating in their national decisions, making only guarantees that daily life conditions and future prospects for these millions of Palestinians will only worsen with every passing month. And for those in refugee camps or under Israeli siege in Gaza, it is hard to imagine how life can get any more difficult. The Palestinians cannot force major changes in the policies of the Israeli government that continues with the same colonial, apartheid-like policies that have defined Zionism since the 1947-48 creation of Israel and the dismemberment, disenfranchisement, and dispersal of the Palestinians. But 1.5 million Palestinians of 1948 have become 9 million or so today, and they do have the power to do one thing, whether they live in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza, as Israeli citizens inside Israel, or throughout the diaspora around the region and the world. They can and must re-legitimize their national leadership into a single movement that listens to all views, represents them legitimately, reaches policy decisions on the basis of serious consultations and consensus that allows Palestinians to speak in a single voice and engages diplomatically around the world with the full support of Palestinians. None of these dynamics exists today, which is why the current leadership of the PLO under Mahmoud Abbas is not taken seriously in the region or internationally, least of all by the majority of Palestinians themselves, who have looked elsewhere for leadership in the years since the Oslo process proved to be a failure and Yasser Arafat started to lose his credibility. The leaderless condition of the Palestinian people today is reflected in how the three most dramatic examples of public political action in recent years have occurred without any meaningful input from the PLO or from the Palestinian Authority, which administers limited services in regions in the West Bank and Gaza where Israel gives it permission to do so. Those three examples are the current campaign around the world to support Ahmed Tamimi, the 16-year-old girl from a West Bank village who was detained in an Israeli jail pending a possible military court trial because she resisted Israeli occupation and slapped an Israeli soldier. The weeks of spontaneous popular protests last summer in Arab East Jerusalem, when tens of thousands of Palestinians there defended their holy sites at the Haram al-Sharif, and the ongoing boycott, divestment, and sanctions, BDS movement, by civil society to pressure Israel to stop its mistreatment and human rights denials of Palestinians in the three arenas of occupied Palestine, the State of Israel, and the diaspora. Hamas's challenge to the PLO leadership in Gaza is another sign of the PLO's delinquency in protecting, representing, or leading the Palestinians. It is difficult now to create a whole new national leadership given the fragmented nature of the Palestinian community. Yet the cohesion that all Palestinians feel, wherever they live, also makes it feasible to at least start consultations amongst themselves to find a way out of the current nightmare by giving fresh blood and new life and legitimacy to existing PLO organs. There is no reason why we should suffer this ghastly fate of being plagued by a colonial Zionist Israeli state that steadily eats up our land, ignored by a mostly caring world that is otherwise preoccupied by more pressing issues, and abandoned by a Palestinian leadership that has become powerless, dependent on donors, docile, a purveyor of empty cliches, and largely incoherent. Such situations might lull some observers to see the end of the Palestinian issue, while a more likely conclusion would be that this low point will mark the start of a process of rebirth for the 9 million Palestinians who have never stopped struggling and working for their national rights since the 1930s. They are certainly not going to stop now, regardless of the poor quality of their current leaders. That was an analysis of the current crisis in leadership in Palestine, written by Professor Rami Khoury of the American University in Beirut. And now on to our feature presentation this morning, which is another of the conversations that a group of Boston area travelers had on their trip to Palestine, Israel, through the Gerelta Foundation. They sat down with Ray Dolphin of the United Nations Office of the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, assigned to Palestine-Israel. The UN plays a limited but critical role in maintaining the daily affairs of the Palestinian people living under occupation. Ray Dolphin discusses that role in this informal conversation.
So there's OCHA. It's the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. A bit of a long-winded title, but it's the humanitarian arm of the UN. So it's not only in what we call the occupied Palestinian territories. It's a global UN organization, and it was set up in the 1990s to coordinate response after conflict or during conflict, natural disasters and wars. So, for example, there probably will be an OCHA mission following the hurricane to the Caribbean once it passed. That's the type of the disaster response. To coordinate it, not to. Actually, Israel is a member of the global response. They've got quite good experience, I think. So that's after natural disaster. And then there are certain offices where it's meant to be temporary because the whole emergency humanitarian context is supposed to be temporary. But there are places like Afghanistan and Syria, which are quite long-term missions, as you can imagine, particularly Afghanistan. Yemen, we have a mission for Yemen at the moment. And here is a little bit different because we don't have a natural disaster and we don't have war as such. We have wars in Gaza or conflicts. So this is called a complex emergency. And it's here what we say basically all of the issues here are as a result of violations of international law. Particularly international humanitarian law. We have international humanitarian law and international human rights law, but we do the international humanitarian law. Which means here, technically, this is a very easy problem to solve, the Israeli-Palestinian, because it's a small area, small numbers involved, relatively well-off area, particularly on the Israeli side. And there is what's more, there is an internationally approved resolution to the conflict, which in theory everybody has signed up to, with the exception perhaps of Hamas, but the Israelis, the Palestinians, and the international media. And that's the two-state solution, which means there's supposed to be a Palestinian state in the West Bank with some type of shared capital in Jerusalem and then some connection with Gaza, which is stuck over on the other side. And that's been the official, it's been the official position for the international community for probably the last 30 or 40 years. And it's been the official mechanism, if you like, since the Oslo Accords in 1994, which we look at in more depth. However, as you probably know and you'll certainly see in the next 10 days, the reality on the ground is rather different, to the extent that although there's no, last week we had the Secretary General here, he was sitting exactly where you were, and we were doing the same briefing. He said publicly there's no plan B to the two-state solution, but in practice on the ground it doesn't look, to put it mildly, very healthy at this stage. To the extent that a lot of people, including, I must say, myself, unofficially, would say that it's gone. And the fact that there's no plan B is a problem. Now, you will hear, and probably people like Mazen Qumsi will, there are Palestinians who talk about a one-state solution, and there's lots of variations on that, federation, confederation, whatever. I don't have a problem with it. In many ways, it's a more fair or perhaps equitable solution than a two-state solution. The only problem I have with it is I don't think it's ever going to happen.
Seems
so the idea, if we're stuck between a failing which I think was possible, a two-state solution. I don't think it was necessarily a just solution. I don't think there is a just solution to this, but it was at least a reasonable solution. But if it's gone, which I think it is, and the one-state solution doesn't look, then we're stuck with indefinite occupation, which I suspect is going to be the scenario, at least for the foreseeable future. Who knows? Nobody can tell the future, as you know, and things are changing in the region and globally, but for the foreseeable future. That's, of course, not the UN position. The UN position still is no plan B or plan A, which is the two-state solution, but informally, and perhaps this shouldn't be broadcast, no, it's okay, but that's true. Informally and off the record, most people are losing hope in it, and certainly most Palestinians are losing hope in it. Because
that's the sense that we had. You know, we saw you at the beginning of our trip in January. Yeah. The sense that I had from that trip was that the Palestinians are much more concerned about having decent lives than additional aspirations to a separate state.
Well, they don't.
The younger ones.
Yeah, they don't see it coming. So, what people are doing, I think increasingly you'll see Palestinians go down the civil rights or equal rights. Okay. You don't want to give a state. We won't ask for a state. All we want is the same rights as you, which will take it in a different area and will be much more difficult to argue against.
And you talk to Eve Spangler, as I recall. She comes every year to Boston College.
Yeah, yes,
and
correct.
That's exactly, you know, she's got a book that she's made that case exactly the same one you just
I think that's the way it's going to go. As the two-state. I mean, we do have a... We seem to have a peace process of, not a process, but something of sorts with President Trump, and who famously said, one state, two state, whatever you're having, I'll have it, or whatever. So we don't know what that means. Frankly, it doesn't look like it's going to amount to very much already. So that's, I mean, the US is still the most important outside actor when it comes to here. The European Union is the pair, the expression there, the pair, but not the player. The European Union, well, actually the US puts in quite a lot of money as well, but the European Union also has a vested interest. Of course, it's on Europe's doorstep, I think, but they basically step aside and let the US drive things. And we have what's called the quartet, supposedly as the holders of the process, and that's the US, the EU, the Russian Federation, and the UN, which is a bit odd because all of the others are in the UN anyway. So, but effectively it's the US. So if this US initiative doesn't lead to anything, I don't know. I mean, there is no plan B, partly because they don't know what plan B is, but also because to admit now that plan A has failed is a huge admission. All the money that went in, all the energy, all the diplomatic activity, and if after 20, and it is almost 25 years now, you admit that it's all been for naught, then there should be some accountability. So anyway, just to say that we're not in a particularly good situation. And I'm talking mainly of the West Bank because, and we shouldn't forget Gaza, and we look at Gaza first, but ultimately Gaza will either sink or swim, almost literally, depending on what happens in the West Bank, because the West Bank is where it's going to, the particularly two-state, is going to succeed or fail. And Gaza has no future in and of itself. It needs to be connected with some other, whether... The plan of the two-state solution is that it should be connected with the West Bank. The other alternative is to connect it with Egypt. Egypt clearly doesn't want that, but where it is now, and maybe that's a good thing, let's quickly start with... this is where we are. We're here in East Jerusalem, which you can see is the narrowest part of the West Bank. And here's the Gaza Strip over there. Now, when we talk about... We refer to the occupied Palestinian territory, singular, and the reason is that the West Bank and Gaza are supposed to be one territorial unit. Now, there's an obvious problem when you look at the map in that Israel is in between the sovereign state of Israel splits the two. In 1947, when we had the partition plan, and there was supposed to be an Arab state and a Jewish state, there was, the West Bank did have a link to actually Jaffa here, but that didn't happen. The Gaza Strip is as a result of the first war. So what we have is we have territorial separation. Now, under the Oslo Accords, there was supposed to be a territorial link. The suggestion was from here to here. It's only 40 kilometres, so it's not far, and the distances here are not very far. And it would go through Israel, so probably a road or a or a tunnel or a bridge, which would go through Israeli territory, but you could technically have some type of bus or train that starts here, just passes through and comes here. And while it goes through Israel, it's under Israel control. It's transiting basically, but it would allow movement between in both directions, and also for goods, some type of road connection or something. And that was never implemented. So the Gaza Strip has been increasingly separated from. And there's been additional problems. In 2007, we had effectively a short-lived civil war in Gaza between Hamas and the Fatah, or the Palestinian Authority, which Hamas won. And since then, in addition to physical separation, we have political separation because the two entities are not under the... We have the Palestinian Authority in control of some of the West Bank, and Hamas in control of Gaza. So there's a political divide as well, which doesn't help. And as far as the international community is concerned, Hamas is a terrorist organization, so nobody speaks to them. So, for example, when the Secretary General went last week to Gaza, he didn't meet with anyone from Hamas. He didn't. There was no liaison. I mean, there's de facto a liaison, but he did. So he went. To all intents and purposes, Hamas rules the territory, but nobody speaks to them. Now, since the Hamas takeover, there's been certain consequences. One is the Israelis have imposed a blockade on Gaza, which has eased somewhat, but what it means is it's sealed off on the land side, fenced in, and by sea, at least Gaza has the sea, access to the Mediterranean, you can only go 6 nautical miles out. And then it's patrolled by the Israeli Navy, and they will fire at or confiscate or any boat that tries to go beyond that. So the fishing industry in Gaza has pretty much collapsed. We've also had three effectively wars since, one in 2008-2009, one in 2012, and the latest was in 2014. Which was the most severe. So we had over 2,000 people killed, we say mainly civilians. And we had 100,000 people homeless, 18,000 homes destroyed or severely damaged. There's 2 million people in Gaza. It's one of the most densely populated places in the world. And of the 100,000, there's still 30,000 displaced 3 years later because their homes haven't been. One of the difficulties is getting construction. Well, one of the difficulties is funding, as always, and that is a problem because this is a long-term issue. There's donor fatigue, and of course we have other regional demands. We have particularly Syria and Yemen and Egypt and Libya, so it's not the only conflict in the area. So we've had those three conflicts. The other issue is that Gaza has a border with Egypt. Israel clearly wishes that Egypt would take responsibility for Gaza. They were in control of Gaza between 48 and 67. Egypt has no intention of it. Egypt has 90 million people of its own, a huge population. Lots of poverty, lots of unemployment. The last thing they want is another 2 million to be responsible for. And anyway, they are correct. As far as we're concerned, Israel is the responsible. It's up to Egypt. It's up to Israel to open the crossings to allow access between Gaza and West Bank. It's not up to Egypt to open their crossings here to allow access between Gaza and Egypt, because Israel is the duty bearer here, not Egypt. And that's because, as far as the international community is concerned, the UN, Israel is still the occupying power in Gaza. It's true they're not physically inside anymore, but as long as you control the border and the airspace and the sea, effectively you are the occupying power. So you are responsible for the welfare, and you're responsible for allowing people in and out of Gaza. Since 2013, we had the overthrow of President Morsi in Egypt and the arrival of first General Sisi and now President Sisi. Now, General Morsi was part of the Muslim Brotherhood. Hamas is part of the Muslim Brotherhood. So for that year, there was good relations between Egypt and Gaza. Since the arrival of General Sisi, there's very bad relations between the Egyptian authorities and Gaza. Among other things, the Egyptians say Hamas was involved in the troubles in Gaza. Not just, they say they were actually involved in 2013, which is a bit far. But in the Sinai here, we have an insurrection, we have an ISIS-type group. And according to the Egyptians' authorities' claim is that Hamas is supporting them. And as a result, they've closed the border, effectively. It's been closed, effectively, for the last 4 years. So it's very difficult for anyone to leave from Gaza to Egypt. And, for example, Gaza fishermen used to go down here to fish. They don't allow them anymore. They've closed all the smuggling tunnels. There used to be lots of smuggling tunnels. They've closed those. So, effectively, we've got two blockades on Gaza. One by Israel, with some easing, and one by Egypt. So the Rafah crossing here is almost entirely closed. It used to be the main access point for Gazans to leave. And if that's not bad enough, we have increasing issues between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority. The international community's position is that Hamas is illegitimate. It's a terrorist organization and it took over by force. In itself, that's correct, but Hamas did win the elections in 2006 democratically, and there was a short-lived unity government, and there was supposed to be reconciliation. So, recently, what the authority in Ramallah is putting the squeeze on Hamas. So, for example, they're no longer paying for the electricity in Gaza. There's a Gaza power plant which needs fuel, which Ramallah used to pay for, which they're no longer doing. And Gaza also gets some electricity from Egypt for the southern part, and it also gets electricity from Israel, which the Palestinian Authority used to pay for. Somebody needs to pay for it. And the PA has told Israel that they're no longer paying for the electricity for Israel, so understandably enough, Israel has cut back on the electricity to Gaza, and the power plant isn't working most of the time. So in the summer we had power cuts, or let's say for most of the summer, for a lot of the summer, it was only 2 hours of electricity a day in Gaza. So that's it is pretty impossible, and there's 2 million people living in this space. One of the consequences of the electricity not working is that the sewage treatment plant doesn't work because it needs electricity cycle. So what they're doing and what they're having, they're discharging the sewage into the sea, either untreated or partially treated, with the result that Gaza beaches were closed for most of the summer. And we had the first case of a child dying after swimming and ingesting contaminated whatever, and that's the first documented case. That was a few weeks ago. The prevailing currents are north, as we know the old adage, excuse my French, but shit respects no borders. So the Ashkelon beach had to be, which is in Israel, had to be closed, and the Ashkelon sewage treatment desalination plant was contaminated for a while. So that's clearly something that benefits no one. this. But that's to put the squeeze on Hamas. I mean, the PA has some legitimate in the fact that Hamas collects, most people in Gaza don't pay for electricity because they can't, but when they do pay, Hamas collects it and doesn't send the money to Ramallah. So, but without going into who's blame and or everyone's to blame, of course, it's the people on the ground who pay the price.
Who is paying for the 4 hours a day, Ray?
Well, Israel is still supplying. They didn't totally. They just cut down the PA. So they're getting some. And then they managed to procure some fuel through Egypt. I think United Arab Emirates paid for it. And we pay for some of the UN for the emergency, especially for the hospitals. Now, the hospitals are almost dependent entirely on generators. They're supposed to be backup generators, but they're working most of the time. There's a lot of elective surgeries which have been cancelled because they can't operate or they don't have enough fuel to operate, so they're prioritising it, obviously. And another thing the PA has done recently, most people who leave Gaza to Israel or through Israel are medical patients. There is a health service in Gaza. It's actually quite a good one, but it's rather run down and it's obviously stressed. Now, particularly for cardiac and cancer cases, you have to leave, and you either go to Egypt, which you can't anymore because the crossing is closed most of the time. So you can either go to Israel or you can come to East Jerusalem, and there are good Palestinian hospitals in East Jerusalem. Now, obviously, to go to East Jerusalem, you have to cross Israel, and to cross Israel, you need a permit. So, who pays for it? The Palestinian Authority pays for Gaza patients if they're referred to come to hospitals in East Jerusalem and the cardiac cancer and there's an eye hospital here as well. And some go to Israel, but most come to East Jerusalem hospitals. Some go to Jordan as well. Now, the PA has also been cutting back on the payments for referrals. And that's an issue as well. So we've also had cases. WHO every month brings out a report on referrals from Gaza. We have had cases of patients dying in the last few weeks because they didn't get permits or because they couldn't get referrals. There is an additional problem. Cancer cases, particularly breast cancer patients, there was a big backlog. There was a demonstration. This is back in the end of last year, so there was a bit of an increase on that. And then earlier this year, there was, I can't remember if it was the patient herself or an accompanier, because a lot of patients who come need an escort. They're too young or they're too old or they're too weak. According to the Israeli authorities, was caught at the border carrying some type of weapons-grade thing, which the Israeli authorities say that Hamas was using this woman to smuggle stuff through. That may be correct. So that also doesn't help.
Anecdotes, at least.
Well, it's not that was a direct accusation, so yeah. It wasn't as reported. So, and there are cases of Hamas using patients or business people to bring stuff in and out. Right. So that doesn't help. I mean, nobody's saying that Israel doesn't have genuine security issues. So, but that obviously doesn't help if that's the case with getting people out. So anyway, to summarise, the situation in Gaza is dire. 80% of people are dependent on some type of foreign assistance. And if it didn't have this type of assistance, it wouldn't survive. And in fact, I'll just show you. We did do in 2012, we brought in a report called Gaza 2020, meaning the year 2020, a livable place, questioning if the Gaza Strip would actually be inhabitable in 8 years' time. That was in 2012. It was updated this year, 5 years later. So we've updated some of the main indicators. So by 2020, we'll have 2.2 million, another 0.2 million people, and that's the economy. The estimate for the economy, gross domestic product per capita. Now, we'll just be over 1,000, which actually is less than it was in the 1990s. The Economist brought out a report on Gaza, on the Palestine, for 50 years, and they said the Israeli economy, I think it's $35,000 per year, which is like France. Obviously, Israel is a developed country. The West Bank is $3,000 or $3,500 a year. That's the difference, which is like Egypt. And Gaza, which is this, is like Burkina Faso. So what you have is you have an African country, a rich European country, and a Middle East country, economy rather, living side by side. The employment rate is 42% at the moment. That's the official one's higher. And the prediction is it'll be higher into 2020. With youth employment at 60%, which is the highest in the world. What you have increasingly, there's a lot of people in Gaza going to university, which sounds good in itself, but frankly, the reason a lot of people go is because as you're not unlikely to get employed, you might as well prolong the thing. But all it means is that 3 years later, you have even more educated people unemployed. Health. 1,000-ish, but these are not necessarily 1,000 doctors needed by 2020. Education, by the way, for some reason it's not for 20, but by 2030 there'll be 900 additional schools needed by 2030. Housing, there's already a deficit of 120,000 housing units, that's the thing. But the most important or critical issue is water. Because there's only one resource in Gaza for water. There's no rivers, streams. There's an aquifer. The only reason it can support 2 million people at all is there's actually quite a substantial aquifer, which actually goes all the way up to Tel Aviv, or nearly to Tel Aviv. And the problem with that is it can't support 2 million people. So it has been... The water is being extracted and used faster than it's been replenished. And as a result, the sea has been infiltrating because, of course, it's on the coast, so the seawater infiltrates. And the projection is that this infiltration will be irreversible by 2020. And already WHO says that drinking water in Gaza, only 2% or 3% is potable. By 2020, none of it will be potable. You have to either boil or desalinate. There are desalination units in Gaza, which are also affected by the electricity cuts, of course. But short of a major seawater desalination plant being installed, that's going to be the critical issue. So, in addition to the humanitarian political issues we have now, very soon, in 3 years, we're going to be faced with this critical issue. So we look mainly at the West Bank, but clearly the situation in Gaza is becoming more and more critical, with no obvious solutions on the horizon. It is a disaster, and it's going to be more of a disaster. And obviously, the only solution going back to this is to somehow link it. Well, you can't really say this, but if the resources are not provided, then it's hard to see. most people in Gaza, especially most young people, would probably leave if they could, but they can't. There is some smuggling. There are Gazans getting on the boats from Alexandria to Europe. But even if they do, they're way down on the pecking order. It's Syrians and others who have the priority, obviously. But there is some evidence of people, but physically they can't. The Egyptians, the last thing the Egyptians do will open the borders because they're afraid they'll stay in Egypt. So unless there's some way of reuniting the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, then it's difficult to see how it's going to be resolved. Let's go to the West. Any questions on Gaza? There's not much to say, actually. Well, it is soluble, but it is
require huge compromise.
It would need political will. We don't see that happening. So I really don't know. I mean, I suspect we'll be doing reports Gaza 2025 a livable place, because of course when you say it's unlivable, all things is that people's expectations and standards just shrink. So, you know, gas could probably take 3 million people, but it'll just be a much worse place. But the issue is that it's also a question of how long the international community is going to pay for it, because that's the only thing that's sustaining it at the moment. So, but yeah, I mean, there needs to be a political solution. And, you know, going back to the one state solution, I don't see the Israeli authorities saying, okay, let's everyone, because the one state solution is not just everyone having equal rights, it's also having the right to live anywhere within the... I don't see the Israeli authorities saying, okay, we gave it up in the two state, let's all live happily together, and by the way, you 2 million people in Gaza are welcome to come and live anywhere between the Mediterranean and the River Jordan, which is why I'm saying that whatever about the two-state solution, you can query it in many aspects and the how just it is, but it was a realistic, I think, at one stage. And you have to remember when the Oslo Accords were broached, probably the population of Gaza was just over a million. So, yes, because it has doubled in the last 20, 25 years.
Is there any mention of a one-state solution?
By whom?
The UN.
Now, the UN, as the Secretary General said, there's no plan B. And I don't know at what stage...
Right now, they're tinkering with pieces and crises.
Well, it's not even... It's been managed at the moment. I'm not even sure it's been managed, frankly. But I don't know if the current trends continue. At some stage, it will be impossible to even pretend that there is going to be a two-state solution. And then I don't know what
two-state solution seems awfully complex.
Well, it's not complex at all, actually.
Oh, really?
As a solution, it's very easy.
Well, geographically, it is.
No. I mean,
the land is not contiguous. But
no, but that's why you have a connection, and that's. I mean, it's only 40 kilometers from. Even if you did it as a tunnel. From an engineering point of view, it's relatively easy. So, that's not difficult at all. The logistics or the engineering of it is not difficult. It's the politics of it. But as long as Israel wants to separate the West Bank and Gaza, which they clearly do, but without having a solution to what's going to happen to Gaza, that's not going to happen. And Gaza clearly, in as of itself, doesn't have any future. It's not going to survive by itself. It has to be connected with some bigger. If it's well, you could expand it, of course. You could, Israel could give some land, or Egypt could give some land, yeah. And that would obviously ease it, but that wouldn't solve it. It has to be connected to some other territory. Now, Israel would clearly would hope Egypt will do it, but Egypt's not going to do it, and nor should they do it. So Israel's not going to absorb them. So the only solution is to absorb it, to link it to the West Bank, but that doesn't seem. Israel clearly doesn't want that. So, but in of itself, there's no solution for Gaza. It has to be linked with some type of larger territory.
So, does the West, I'm not particularly knowledgeable about all of this, but the West Bank itself seems to be in turmoil.
Well, this is what we look at.
All that Israel is.
Yeah, well, that's what we look at. Now, this is the West Bank, much larger than Gaza, 15 times the size, only 50% more population, so it shouldn't have the same problems with resources as Gaza's. There's no link to the sea, but of course, if there was a link to Gaza, that would allow a link by the West Bank to the sea and a port, if there was this connection.
Isn't Israel effectively moving into the West Bank?
Well, that's what we'll see. So let's look at what's happening to the West Bank, how it's being affected. First of all, we have all these settlements, and they're pretty much everywhere, as you can see, from the very top to the very tip of, you'll be down here in the southern Hebron Hills. There's settlements everywhere, and that obviously physically fragments the territory. And that's just the built-up area of the settlements. So
those are all Israeli property under Israeli.
These are all Israeli towns, effectively, which have been created in the West Bank.
Have been interconnected to some extent by.
They're all linked by roads.
Right.
Yes. So, and these are all illegal under international law. An occupying power.
They are illegal.
Illegal.
Yeah.
An occupying power is not allowed to move its It's not allowed to change the status of the territory. You can occupy it as a result of war. That's not necessarily illegal. But if you do, you're not allowed to change the status. And you're not allowed to change it physically. And you're not allowed to change it demographically.
Of course, which has been done.
Which has begun. There's now 600,000 Israeli settlers in the West Bank. So it's 20% of the Palestinian population. And growing faster. Because you've got member states. And, of course, they're full citizens. The Palestinians are under military rule. They don't have any access to, as you'll see when you go to the... you're going to Ofir military prison, which is a joke, frankly. It's industrialized. What basically happens is, because so many people are arrested, they just do deals with the lawyer. They do plea bargains. So they all just clear the system. So we have 600,000 Israelis who have full rights, who remember the difference in the economy. The Israeli economy is 10 times the size of the Palestinian economy. So they have economic advantages. All the resources are for their benefit. And as we'll see, this first there is just the built-up area. That's not the land.
The influence goes far.
Right. So that's what's built on. This is what this is the land which has been confiscated and given to the municipalities, which is more, as you can see, particularly here, all the Jerusalem area. And then this is the land that's been confiscated and given to the regional councils. So most of the land, and this is not all, by the way, there's other layers. Most of the land in the West Bank has been expropriated by using all sorts of means, laws, military order, and de facto handed over to Israel. And we don't even have the water here. It's the same water. Most water in the West Bank is for the benefit of Israel or for settlers rather than it's not a thing. You go to a settlement, you see swimming pools, and nearby you'll have Bedouin communities who are not even connected to the water network and have to pay for tankered water. So the inequality is not just in terms, it's everything from allocation to resources to provision of services. There's total inequality. So that's the settlement. You'll hear a lot about settlements.
Well, that can't survive in the long run.
Not in the long run, but it's been 50 years now. In June we marked...
And becoming more pervasive.
And becoming more pervasive and more interconnected. It's not just... Because this is just settlements. We look at other things and they're all interconnected. So...
Well, it sounds ultimately as if Israel will take over the West Bank.
Well,
integrated with...
Yeah, effectively, but there is a problem. They don't want the population, the Palestinian population. So what do you do with three...
You're damned in either case.
Well, what you do is you take the resources and you cantonize the people, which effectively is what happened. And if the international community is paying for, which they are, then in a way you've got the best of all worlds where you're getting all the resources from the West Bank, but you're not paying any of the price for it. So that's settlements. Then we have the wall or the barrier, which is here, which you'll see it in Bethlehem, because there's a big wall between Bethlehem and East Jerusalem.
You see some of it coming in there.
If you came in 443, it's this road. You actually came like this, so this part you would have seen. You would have come down here. You would have seen some of its wall and some of its fence, but it's all interconnected. So that's also changing the landscape, as you can see. And in particular, it's cutting off farmers from their land, which is a big issue, because you need permits. That's a big thing in the West Bank, permits and ID cards. Permits to come to Israel, permits to cross the wall, etc., etc. I should say that East Jerusalem has been annexed by Israel. It's not recognized by the international community, but it has been annexed. And then we have all the different checkpoints and... Okay. Now, we had over 500 ops. They're not all checkpoints. There's earth mounds, and we've got earth mounds and roadblocks and gates, lots of gates on roads which can be open or closed or locked, etc., etc. So it's very physically fragmented, the West Bank, as you can see. And one reason we monitor it is because, you know, as a humanitarian arm, as you can imagine, this causes problems for people getting to school or to hospitals. For example, we mentioned in East Jerusalem, all of the major hospitals for Palestinians are in East Jerusalem. The cardiac hospitals, the cancer treatment hospitals, the eye hospitals. We mentioned the problems that people from Gaza have to come to East Jerusalem. But also, if you're in Bethlehem or Ramallah, you also need a permit to come to East Jerusalem as a patient. Now, they're easier to get. In Gaza, hardly anyone gets them. In the West Bank, about 80% of people who apply get them, which is better. But it does mean 20% of people are refused. And again, in most cases, they're coming because it's the specialized hospitals. So there are hospitals in Ramallah and Bethlehem.
So what happens to that 20%?
Then they have to go...
Wherever else.
I mean, there are good hospitals, but again, the best ones are in East Jerusalem, particularly, and the cardiac specialists are in East Jerusalem, etc., and the cancer ones, and the facilities are in East Jerusalem. So 20% of people refuse. That's quite a lot if you think about it, if you're actually applying for specialized, because for most of the things you can get it in Ramallah or Nablus or Hebron. There are good hospitals there. You don't need to come to Jerusalem for normal procedures. Effectively, you are. And again, WHO monitors that. So it's better than Gaza, clearly. But it's still not anything near acceptable.
We have to leave it there as we've run out of time. You have been listening to a conversation with Ray Dolphin of the UN's Office of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, wishing you a good morning.